Well, the Joyful Vampire Tour celebrates a new DIY film, Bite Me, written by and starring Woody Creek native Naomi McDougall Jones. The tour visits the Aspen District Theater tonight and the Glenwood Vaudeville Theater tomorrow night. Naomi joins the show now to tell us about it. Welcome, Naomi.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, the pairing of the two words, joyful and vampire, don't happen very often. I think of creepy and scary and sexy, but tell me how it's joyful.
Well, so the tour itself is very joyful. The film is joyful. The film is a subversive romantic comedy about a real life vampire and the IRS agent who audits her. So although there's an edginess to the film, it's ultimately a film about hope and love and rekindling our joy and acceptance of others and ourselves. So that was the spirit we are trying to capture in the Joyful Vampire Tour of America, which has been as joyful as it has been vampire-y so far.
Oh, well, you know, I watched your YouTube channel episodes, and I loved at the end of some of them, the interviews with the vampires.
Yes.
Really cool. How did you run into them? They're really
interesting. So in 2011, I was acting on HBO's Boardwalk Empire, and I got chatting with one of the background actors one day on set, and she revealed to me over the course of a 16-hour shoot day that she is a vampire. And I was like, what? And then because I'm a writer, I was like, okay, well, tell me everything. And she explained to me that there is a real life global community of people who identify as vampires and do drink human blood to stay healthy. And I just went home and fell down the internet rabbit hole of researching them and watching their vlogs on YouTube and just became completely fascinated and kind of inspired by this group of people who live their truth so fully, even as it alienates them from a lot of society.
Well, it took you 5 years to write and 48 drafts.
Oh, yeah. But my first film, I rewrote 52 times. So I feel like the process is strengthening and improving.
Well, what was it you were looking for that took you 48 drafts to accomplish?
Well, it's just, I think it can always be better. You know, I think it was Arthur Miller who said that plays are never finished, only abandoned. And that's sort of how I feel about scripts. I just keep rewriting and refining and honing and making it better until they pry it out of my hands and we go into production. But you're always in search of the perfect draft.
Well, it's fair to say that your character, Sarah, has a massive chip on her shoulder, maybe both shoulders.
Yeah.
And yet, she transcends that.
Yeah.
There's a transformational arc to her story. Obviously, that was intended. Tell me more about that. You've already sort of alluded to it.
Yeah. Well, so the character that I play, who's the main character of the film, she identifies as a vampire. She's a member of that community. And one of the initial impulses behind writing this movie was that I wanted to write a great romantic comedy because I love romantic comedies as a viewer, and it's made me so sad that genre has taken such a horrible nosedive in the last decades. You know, I loved them in the 80s and 90s when they were great and smart and funny and just well-made movies. And so part of what I was thinking about is how do you update that genre, because those 80s and 90s rom-coms sort of thrived on the giddy, freewheeling optimism that existed culturally in those decades, in which it does not exist right now. And but of course, that giddy, freewheeling optimism is the stuff of love. And the experience of falling in love is every bit as goofy and earth-shattering and silly and beautiful as those movies are. So as I was trying to figure out how you update the rom-com to get that feeling of love back, but in a context that doesn't feel goofy today, I realized that what you needed was a lead character who begins the film as angry and cynical and jaded as the world right now, and then so that she gets as surprised as we do when the film takes a turn towards the romantic.
Mm-hmm. Well, at one point she says, "You only love me because I'm a vampire." Lots of great lines.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, 48 drafts.
Well, they didn't just fall out of your head like Zeus begatting Athena or something.
No.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's what makes the show engaging for, I would say, all ages and all kinds of people.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been really gratifying and exciting to see how broad a span of humanity responds to this movie. We initially thought it might be a little bit niche because of the vampire thing, but some of our most enthusiastic responses have been from middle-aged women who are totally normal and not vampires and in no way connected to the counterculture. And we had one young audience member who was 7 who told me that it was perfect, which I feel is the best review I've received.
Oh, because you remember when you were that age,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, and the level at which movies affect you at that age, which is so different than as you grow older.
Yeah. You know, I watched you grow up, full disclosure, I'm friends with your parents, and I never considered you from the outside looking in as an outsider, but you talk a little bit about that in some of the postings that I've seen. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. That's funny that you never saw me that way, because I've always seen myself so much that way. And growing up, it felt so painful. As I grew up, and it sort of, I've turned that outsiderness and that difference within myself into a career, but I have so much sympathy for those who still live in that pain of feeling outside and struggle with that. So in many ways, this film is a love song to those people, to anybody who feels unseen or unloved for who they are.
Well, also, as an outsider looking in the filmmaking world, let's talk about how this is a real DIY effort, and including the marketing of the movie, which is why you're here and doing these screenings all around the country. So talk a little bit about why you chose that route.
Yeah. So the film is not a very accommodating place for women in general. To this day, 95% of studio films are directed by men, which is pretty shocking, mostly white men. And so it's pretty hard as a woman to get your films made at all. Many women have been pushed into the independent space, where I love to be anyway, because then you're not answering to anybody but the creation of the thing. But distribution is a place where that has been a huge problem. Women's films are distributed in 25% fewer screens on average than men's. And even outside of that, what's happened as a result of Netflix and streaming and a decline in movie ticket sales is that distributors are now just acquiring masses of independent film content and essentially dumping it into the marketplace with no marketing strategy or dollars behind it. So all of these great independent films are now getting just lost in the abyss of iTunes and Amazon and Netflix, and audiences don't know how to find them. And so the flip side of that is that audiences constantly come up to me and say, why don't they make good movies anymore? And I'm like, oh my God, we are making good movies. You just don't know how to find them. So my first feature film, Imagine I'm Beautiful, did get a traditional distribution deal, even a theatrical distribution deal. And my producing partner, Sarah, had it as well. And we'd had this experience that almost every filmmaker has now, where the results were very disappointing, both financially and from an experiential release perspective. And so when it came time to release this film, we just looked at each other and we said, no, we're not handing this film. It's too good. There's an audience for it. We know where that audience is. It's too good to just hand to a third party that it's going to throw it off a cliff and take 95% of our revenue for that honor. Mm-hmm. So we just started calling theaters and pitching them on the idea of, what if we came and did a screening and did a Q&A after the screening so people could meet the filmmakers? And what if we threw a party after every screening in the form of a joyful vampire ball as an added incentive to get people out of their houses and watching this film in community? And so many theaters said yes, that we actually had to cap the tour at 51 screenings, because we only had 90 days to do the tour and we couldn't do more than 51 in 90 days without dying. and so that has become the Joyful Vampire Tour of America. It began in New York City on May 6th, and it will end back there on August 1st after we've done a complete circumnavigation of the United States.
Well, you have a YouTube channel that you have all posted, I don't know, 8 or 12 or more videos about your adventures on the road. And I didn't watch all of them, but I watched a few of them. And number 8 was the one where I just went, whoa. And it talks about the very thing that you just mentioned, how hard it is to market these independent films. You said at one point, this pit is bottomless.
Yeah. Well, and in terms of the corruption of the distribution companies, it's really, they're exploiting filmmakers and their content. And they're, as I said, they're taking up to 95% of the revenue, not marketing them, pocketing all of the profits and really killing independent film. So this tour is really an attempt to reinvent how independent films are distributed. Part of the reason we're doing that docuseries is not only to give people the chance to follow us on this RV, this insane RV adventure traveling around the country, which is fun, but also to offer ourselves as a fully transparent case study to other filmmakers who might want to replicate or innovate upon what we're doing. So the idea is that by the end of the tour, there will be a full blueprint for what we've done available fully online so that anybody can take it and do it better or do it the same if they want, so that we can empower filmmakers and audiences to reach each other directly and remove these fat, catty middlemen that are really clogging the works.
You were remarkably open about your expectations about marketing. And I wonder, more than halfway into the tour, how's it going? Are you disappointed?
With the financial results?
Yes.
Well, so here's the really interesting piece of this, which is that the tour itself has a very serious cap as to how much money we can actually make on it, because we're doing 51 screenings, but we're only in every city for one night. So there's just a limited number of seats that we can sell. So in terms of how that tour is selling, it's selling really well. We've sold out a lot of places. We've had full theaters most places. But the second piece of this, and the really scalable piece of this model, is the digital sales. So the film is simultaneously available on iTunes, Amazon, and Google Play, and an independent platform called Seed and Spark. And so the idea is, what we're experimenting with is, can this tour, which is finite in terms of revenue, can it drive those online sales, which is infinite and scalable? The tricky thing is that those platforms only give you your numbers every 3 to 6 months. So we won't actually know how the film has performed on those platforms until after the tour is over, which I can say is brutal for marketing efforts, because you can't adjust or pivot in real time. It's part of a power play on the part of those companies, because obviously they have those numbers instantly. But they don't share them, because if they're the only people with that information in real time, that gives them an incredible economic advantage.
You talk about the issues of marketing films, as I said, in that YouTube channel, but also you talk a lot about women in film. In fact, you have a TED Talk that you gave in 2016. What was it called?
What It's Like to Be a Woman in Hollywood.
Yes. Talk a little bit about that. Tell me what you've discovered.
Well, so this trajectory in my career began when I set out to make my first feature film, Imagine I'm Beautiful, and honestly didn't realize there was a women in film problem, and accidentally hired an all-female creative team just by hiring the best people, which we didn't realize was a radical feminist act. We just hired the best people. And we were quickly informed that it was a radical feminist act, and were told things like, well, girls, you know, you're going to need to get a male producer on board at some point just so that people will trust you with their money. And sort of over and over, this endless refrain of nobody wants to see films about women, which on its face just didn't make any sense, since women are 51% of the population and purchase 52% of movie tickets. So that sort of set me on this trajectory of trying to investigate whether or not that was true, what people were telling me, that people, there wasn't a market for films about women. And none of it was true based on the data. So what I began sort of digging into and realizing is that there is this incredible historic and current institutional sexism that bleeds women out of the industry from behind the camera over the course of their whole careers, and results in a world where, if you've watched mostly American mainstream movies in your lifetime, 95% of all of the films that you've ever seen were directed by men, and 80 to 90% of all of the leading characters that you've ever seen were mostly men and mostly white men. So in addition to my own work, I'm now sort of on a war path with other women and activists to change that, because science shows that the films we watch affect our literal brain chemistry, and also our choice of hobbies, our choice of careers, our marital choices, our sense of identity, certainly our views of other people. So the fact that all of that is being funneled right now almost exclusively through the white male perspective is societally a giant problem.
So you and others created a fund called the 51 Fund. Tell me about the 51 Fund.
So the 51 Fund is a private equity fund to finance films by female filmmakers in the independent space with budgets between $500,000 and $15 million. Because what we've discovered is that among the many places in which women get cut out of their careers in the film industry, financing is a huge piece of that. Across industries, studies have shown that investors are far less likely to invest in women's projects. And that's certainly true in films. So the goal of the 51 Fund is to address that and really create a generation of female filmmakers by giving them that first or second chance that they would not otherwise receive in terms of being able to direct with real independent film budgets.
So a budding filmmaker, a woman, can approach your group and say, hey, here's my project. What do you think? Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah. So we're still raising the fund, but when the fund is fully capitalized, that yes, then there will be an application process, and any film project with a female director that is ready to go into production and needs financing will be able to apply.
And people can get more information at the51fund.com.
Correct.
Yeah. And your movie, BiteMeTheFilm.com.
That's the one.
So let's talk a little bit about what's happening tonight and tomorrow.
Yes. So I get to bring this film home. So tonight, July 10th, it's at the Aspen District Theater at 7 o'clock sharp. We'll have a screening. I'll be there to do a Q&A afterwards, and then we'll be doing a Joyful Vampire Ball following the screening. And tomorrow night, July 11th, we'll be at the Glenwood Vaudeville Review. Same deal. Doors open for dinner at 6, screenings at 7. Q&A and Joyful Vampire Ball. So it will be very, very exciting to bring this film home.
And can people get tickets ahead of time, or are you selling them at the door? Or
people at this time for tonight's screening, just get them at the door. There are still tickets available. And you for tomorrow night, you can either reserve ahead or just show up at the door.
As I said earlier, you're a Woody Creek native. You went to the Aspen Community School, didn't you?
No, I went to Aspen Country Day School.
Oh, you went to Country Day.
I did, because my father was teaching there at the time.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
Did your experience growing up in Aspen put you on the path that you're on now?
Oh, I think so. I mean, there are extraordinary opportunities creatively here. The number of plays I got to be in, both in school and through Aspen Community Theater and other local community theater and professional theater groups, definitely gave me a depth of experience that a lot of people don't get. It's an incredible gift. And also, obviously, the educational system, ACDS, and then going to Aspen High School, a world-class education. And yeah, absolutely. And just a sense of, I think there's such a beautiful community spirit growing up here and feeling safe and supported, and sort of the idea that anything you can dream, you can do, I think is really fostered here. And that's certainly that feeling I haven't lost as I've grown up. And even moving out into the world and having to rely on myself for that support outside of this community, I feel like that spirit has really stayed with me.
What's next for you? Do you have are you working on more scripts?
Oh, of course. I'm on the sixth draft of my third film, which is about a 7-month pregnant woman who gets locked overnight in a castle full of famous ghosts.
Ooh.
So we have a castle tentatively booked to shoot in November 2020, but we've got a lot of money to raise before then, so we'll see. And then I've got a book coming out on February 4th called The Wrong Kind of Woman, Dismantling the Gods of Hollywood, which is about the women in film problem. It expands on the TED Talk and also looks at what we're going to do about it. So that's Beacon Press is publishing that, and it's available for pre-order now on Amazon, and it comes out February 4th.
Do you think things are changing with the Me Too movement?
Sort of. I think the dangerous thing is that it feels like they're changing a lot more than they actually are. The studios are sort of panicked about everybody yelling at them over this stuff, so they're sending out a lot of press releases being like, look, we hired this woman. But the problem is you don't get from 5% of female directors to 51% hiring one woman a year. And actually, the number of female directors in 2018 went down post Me Too to 4%. I think, I know, it's pretty depressing. So I think on-screen representation has improved. That's the place that has improved. The problem is the white men are still the only ones telling the stories. apart from a couple of high profile examples to the contrary. So I think what Me Too has done is given us an opening. And I think now is the critical moment to continue pushing forward. That's why I have this book coming out, because this opening will close. And actually, this conversation of women in film is extremely cyclical in nature. About every 25 years, there's some major outcry. Everybody yells at the studios. The studios send out press releases. Everybody gets tired of talking about it. And it basically goes back to the way it was before. So I think the critical thing is to keep the pressure up and to keep pushing forward in this moment where the press conversation is dying down and the studio executives are getting ready to go back to business as usual.
Well, do you think, do you think that the more talented firebrand women like yourself who are doing it yourself ultimately will change things, won't it?
Absolutely. Well, and that's what a third of the book is about, is this grassroots movement. So what I do think is different this time is that we have the internet and we have social media and we have the ability to reach our audiences directly. So the Joyful Vampire Tour of America simply would not have been possible even 10 years ago because we didn't have the communication tools that we have now to do this. So I think what is different is that from the fringes, we can just make our content and get it to audiences anyway, which will either result in their system becoming irrelevant eventually or will result in them being forced to change because of the pressure from below. Mm-hmm. But I don't trust them to change outside of that kind of grassroots pressure.
Do you trust them enough to where if they came to you and said, hey, we want to release your movie?
I think it would depend on the conversation, and I would get a very good lawyer to read the contract.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, we're always open to working with the system insofar as they will work with us. But certainly I'm aware that also often systems will lift you up into them in order to shut you up. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's another thing we have to be vigilant against here. Yeah.